Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Now it's time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
There's still an ongoing investigation, and we need to let that investigation run through. We should not be afraid once the information comes out to make a decision, but I think we should not be acting right now.
I think there's enough of a violation of what should be his ethics and his impartiality as the chief law enforcement officer of our nation for Congress to be able to question that.
Let me just say I'm considering it, running, and I'll make a final decision soon.
This is kind of a sign of APS digging in its heels. They're under a microscope like never before. You're starting to see more pressure being applied by the Corporation Commission, certainly not as much as some of the anti-APS crowd would like, but you're starting to see a lot more scrutiny.
And with us to talk about President Trump's latest controversial tweets and comments, as well as Arizona's congressional delegation's take on impeachment proceedings and more, our former Arizona Corporation Commission Chair Chris Mays and Barrett Morrison of Morrison Media. Guys, good morning. Thanks
good
for being
morning.
Here.
Good morning.
Good
morning. It's 2003 all over again. Chris Mays and Barrett Morrison going at it.
Together again. Together
you guys
again.
Haven't aged
it's great.
A day, I'm sure.
No.
Chris, let's talk about President Trump's comments, especially as it relates to the rally he had where some of the crowd was saying, send her back in regard to one Democratic congresswoman. What I mean, this is not new, and yet it seems to have been taken to a higher level.
Yeah, this is just something that goes beyond far beyond the pale. And I'll say, as a former Republican, it's so depressing to see this happen. I never thought I would see this happen, where sitting United States president made racist remarks. I mean, blatantly, clearly, overtly racist remarks, and then a crowd of probably mostly Republicans responding by chanting back to him, send them back, about four American congresswomen, three of whom were born here, all of whom are citizens, obviously. So really depressing, and shows that we have a lot of work to do in this country. But, from a political standpoint, I'll add, this is just another sort of thing that's going to erode support for the Republican Party among moderates. And it's not helpful to Republicans.
Generally, I don't get it. I don't understand why go there. But I will say it has absolutely changed our national conversation. We are talking about four freshmen, I think they're all freshmen, congresswomen from across the country that I should never have really heard of. I don't know who the congressperson from the 4th district in Georgia is. I have no idea. But we are talking about these four women, and we aren't talking about Joe Biden. We aren't talking about Kamala Harris or Bernie Sanders and all their proposals. The conversation has changed, particularly on cable and talk radio. And so in that way, and maybe that was Donald Trump's desire and mission, and if that was it, he has succeeded wildly. But from a long-term strategy, I don't think that it's in much helpful to him or certainly to the Republican Party.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, yes, he has changed the conversation, but is the way the conversation is going now helpful to the president and helpful to Republicans? It seems like having to defend yourself as not being a racist is maybe not the way that you want to be kicking off your reelection campaign.
Yeah, I would prefer to talk about why the Diamondbacks are so bad this year or, do they really have a shot at making the playoffs? I'd rather talk about that than, is the Republican Party, one of just white people.
Well,
and so I think that's a problem, and that's a conversation, the Republican Party should be trying to expand its base.
Right.
Hispanics are, first of all, many of them are conservative in their beliefs. Many of them are religious, so they are a good target for Republican policies. But yet some Republicans are talking about, sending them back. And, if you sent everybody back from where they came from, Arizona would be the size of Wyoming.
You know, and it's just, you know, it goes beyond the Republican Party being the party of white people. Now, you know, people are going to be asking, is it the party of racists? And that is not something that the Republican Party needs going into 2020. And, you know, Martha McSally is running around Capitol Hill apparently right now, you know, on her cell phone, desperately trying to avoid reporters asking her about this. I mean, this is the last thing that vulnerable Republican senators need as they're trying to resist what is clearly going to be a Democratic wave in 2020. So it's you know.
I don't know that it'll be a Democratic wave. I think that is, there's a long, long time. The economy is doing very well. And if people vote with their pocketbooks rather than some of these ancillary just topics, then it will not be a Republican wave, or I'm sorry, a Democratic wave. And I think Republicans will hold their own. But, I mean, it's way too early to tell. There's so much time between November, you know, now and November 2019, much less 2020.
Well, Chris, I like what you brought up about Senator McSally. It could apply to Senator Sinema as well, even though she's a Democrat. But, Barry, hold on one second. But what sort of pressure should we put or expect from any candidate or an elected official? Because many people in the public say, why are they not speaking out? And in some cases, from a moral standpoint, they should. But what good does it do for them if they do that? I mean,
well,
what does it do for the country?
Yeah, I mean, from my standpoint, I think that there is a moral imperative for every, especially every Republican elected official to speak out about this. I mean, obviously, far more Democrats have spoken out against what Trump said in his racist comments. But I have not heard a peep from Governor Doug Ducey, not a peep from Brnovich, not a peep from Kimberly Yee, not a peep from Martha McSally. So where are they? Is a moral imperative. This is not just about politics. These are not ancillary issues. Okay. This goes to the core of who we are as a people, and where are they? And history will judge these folks. History will judge these folks on their silence at this critical moment in our country's history.
You know, Chris, one person who hasn't also said a peep is Kyrsten Sinema, Senator Kyrsten Sinema. You'd think someone who just won election, who has 6 years, she could take a little bit of a chance, if you will, and say something. She has been absolutely silent on this issue. And I think that speaks a lot about why very few people in Arizona are speaking out. If Kyrsten Sinema, who just won election a few months back, isn't and is safe for another 5.5 years, isn't saying anything, doesn't that tell you a lot about where Arizona is?
No, I don't, because I don't think this is where. I don't think Arizona believes that our elected officials should be racist. I mean, I don't think Arizonans support Trump in that respect. And so, you know, I agree. I think every single elected official in the state of Arizona has a duty to speak out against this. And every single elected official in Arizona will be judged eventually based on what they did or didn't do in response.
What is the threshold, do you guys think, for replying, for example, in this case, to something the president tweeted? I mean, we heard from Jeff Flake earlier, who said, you know, he's not one who believes that members of Congress and Republicans especially should have to respond to every single thing the president tweets. But he said this is one of those, excuse me, where they should. Barrett, what is the threshold? I mean, this seems like a pretty big one.
This may be a big one, but everyone is, and the media makes everything that Trump, I mean, you know, we all like to say, oh, Stephanie Grisham, who has Arizona ties, is now the press secretary. She'll be the biggest voice. You know, we haven't heard from Stephanie Grisham. Why? Because really, Donald Trump is his own, you know, press secretary. He does everything, and he sets the agenda every single morning. But you know what? If I'm a congressman or woman or a senator, I'm kind of turning off Twitter at 6 in the morning because, you know what? I don't think I want to know what – because I don't want to have to, I have my own agenda. I have my own things I want to do. I have constituents to help. I got, you know, a lot of bills that I'm running. I don't want to spend my whole day wondering what how I'm going to respond to something that Donald Trump has said, you know, about something I am not involved
but
in.
But isn't that just a convenient excuse? I mean, this we're talking about an existential challenge and threat to what we are and who we are as a country. And I know, I'm sure it's convenient to say, oh my goodness, I can't respond to every Looney Tune thing that our president says or is every racist thing that he says, but you know, to Mark's point, there comes a point where things are so bad that demand a response.
I would rather my congressman or woman and my senator spend time on fixing the border issue, on fixing kids in cages, which I think is a policy problem that has real implications. And, you know, Donald Trump's tweets don't, but kids in cages have an issue, are an issue. The porous border is an issue. And I'd rather them spend time on that, and that's what I'm hoping that they do at some point in time over the next 18 months or however long till November.
So very cynical question, though. At what point do politicians, when they become elected officials, completely lose a spine or backbone? I mean, is that acceptable? I mean, because we can make the excuses we all want. Once you get in there, do you change who you are as a person, or is it about policy? Are they putting out policy points? If someone says to them, you know, what do you think about the president's tweets? Should they say, okay, I don't want to talk about that, but here's what I think we should do about immigration or the border? Are we hearing that?
I don't know that we're hearing much, first of all, because everyone only wants to talk about Donald. Again,
Do they want to?
Yes, absolutely. Everybody, well, the media really wants to talk about this. Again, if you turn, I watch, you know, I sit in front of my desk and I have CNN on in the background.
When you're at the barber.
Right. And 24/7, it is about Donald Trump's tweets all the time. I mean, they have four panelists on at a time, and then the next hour they got another four panelists, and they're all talking about the same exact thing. And we rarely hear about good policy stuff. We rarely hear, you know, I mean, frankly, Kyrsten Sinema had a bill about home, veterans and making sure that they, you know, find homes. I mean, that's kind of a big deal, but we're not going to read about that. We're not going to look at it. We're not going to read about it. We're not going to hear about it because right now we want to know what she has to say about a tweet from Donald Trump. And I think that that is that's a problem, a media-driven problem, and I'm not really I'm not going to blame the media because we are also, the public is taking it in. You know, the media is giving us what we want, if you will. I just think we shouldn't want that. We should want a bigger discussion on what is happening in the halls of Congress, what is happening at our state legislature, and we're not really having that because we're so focused on the ridiculousness of the tweets.
Well, it's the ridiculousness of our president at this point, and that's the problem. And he doesn't allow for the room. He doesn't allow for the room for those discussions.
Does it change anything quickly, Barrett? Does it change anything when it goes from a series of tweets to a public event where you have, as Chris referenced earlier, a room full of thousands of supporters yelling, send her back?
Yeah, you know, send her back, lock her up. You know, there is certainly it's certainly newsworthy when you have, you know, a room or an arena chanting that, and they are egged on by Donald Trump. And I wish he would change that conversation. And again, I wish he would change the conversation to, you know, the economy is doing great. To, you know what, I'm putting more money into border control. I wish we could talk much more about that. And much less about sending a congresswoman back to the Bronx.
Yeah, maybe she should just take more naps. Mix those in instead of going to Twitter. Right?
I've always found a nap works.
That's Barrett Morrison of Morrison Media. Also with us is former Arizona Corporation Commission Chair Chris Mayes. With Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. The newscap continues after this. This is the Friday Newscap on KJZZ with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Our guests this morning are Chris Mayes, former Arizona Corporation Commission Chair, and Barrett Morrison of Morrison Media. Chris, we have heard from Arizona's congressional delegation, the Democrats, who want to see some impeachment inquiry when it comes to President Trump. When it came to an actual vote, we're talking semantics to some extent. Not all of them voted to go that way. What do you make of how that went?
So, I mean, it's my understanding that a couple of them decided not to vote for this particular resolution, which was, I think, offered by Representative Green. And I think one of the reasons was it did not focus on the Mueller report. It did not focus on Mueller's findings. It was more focused on the racist comments by Trump we were just talking about. And my sense is, I guess, suggest maybe two things are going on. Number one, probably congressional leadership wants to find the best vehicle or hold off until they find a good vehicle. They've got these investigations going on, so they've got to do that. And it may just be that, you know, some folks are getting pressure from leadership not to go down that road yet. But I don't know what Barrett thinks about that particular vote.
Well, you know, I found it interesting, first of all, that someone like Ruben Gallego didn't vote. Yeah. And he's sort of a part of leadership, right? I mean, he's got some deputy minority assistant to the whip position. So that one I sort of understood. I was surprised maybe Greg Stanton, who has been so vocally anti-Trump throughout the last few years, that one surprised me. I would have thought he would have been all on board with that. The one that didn't surprise me, and I think the one that truly shows sort of where we're at politically here in Arizona, is Tom O'Halloran. He voted against it. I don't think he's going to be there unless there is truly that smoking gun because of that district. That district, while leans Democrat, is a very competitive district, is a conservative Democratic district. So he is going to have to walk the finest of lines. I'm not surprised Raul Grijalva and Anchor Patrick, you know, voted for it. But Greg Stanton surprised me because he's just rabidly anti-Trump and will take any opportunity to slam him. So
I don't know if I would call him rabidly anti-Trump. Do you think he's rabidly anti-Trump?
Remember how he wanted to fire the lobbyist for the city of Phoenix because that firm employed Jan Brewer, who was a supporter of Donald Trump? So no. He's rabidly anti-Trump.
Well, I mean, he's been courageous and brave and, you know.
Those are two words to describe the things.
Actually, I think he's been more out there than a lot of members of Congress, and I think he's said the things that need to be said about Trump. And so I'm glad
Why do you think he didn't vote?
I think he actually didn't vote for it because it was the wrong vehicle. I really think that there were several people who thought it was a bad vehicle for doing this. There have been, I think, now 5 impeachment bills and votes. So, you know, they haven't settled on the right particular bill yet, I don't think.
This is turning out to be the Democratic version of repeal and replace. Republicans, you know, voted on in the House, voted on that 38 times.
Yeah.
And now the Democrats are going to vote on impeachment a like number of times.
Barrett, to your point about O'Halloran, he is the one member of Arizona's Democratic delegation in the House who has not called for opening an impeachment inquiry. And I'm wondering if I think Chris's point is, I mean, I've read similar things that there are different reasons for members voting no in terms of this isn't the right reason, it didn't go through the Judiciary Committee, all sorts of reasons like that. But when you try to explain that to constituents, it seems like a yes or no. Like, it doesn't seem like a lot of constituents are looking for a lot of nuance on this issue.
Right. Now, I will say in CD1, which is rural Arizona for the most part.
Is.
Right. And Flagstaff, a little bit down into Pinal County and Pima County. I think Pima County.
Apache, Navajo.
Greenlee, the populous Greenlee County. you know, they actually do pay attention to what their congressmen do that district. That is a district where people know who their congressman is. So watching him explain that away is maybe a little difficult. But at the same time, again, that is a conservative Democratic district. They probably like a lot of Trump's policies more than most other Democratic districts, if you will. They may also be offended by the tweets and all that stuff, but they like his policies and want to see, you know, less restrictions on coal plants because that's where they get their power from. Mm-hmm. Less restrictions on, some of the other things at Washington, you know, in the farming community. So they, O'Halloran has to toe a line. And this may shock you, Mark. I know your sensibilities, but I think but I think politics is at play in this.
Is there money involved too, Barrett?
There might not.
But the politics, I mean, I agree with Barrett on his assessment of O'Halloran's district for sure, having been born and raised in northern Arizona in Prescott. But I will say this, and it may not change for O'Halloran's calculus, but the more Donald Trump says makes racist comments about sitting American members of Congress and does the kinds of things he did this week, the easier it's going to be for these guys to cast these votes. So, or at least to be more vocal about it.
In rural Arizona, they're not on Twitter.
Like, no, I agree. You don't have to tell me about rural Arizona. I'm from rural Arizona. I know rural Arizona.
I visited rural Arizona just 3 weeks ago. I was like in a yurt or something up there.
Okay.
All right. Chris, let's move on to Arizona Public Service, APS, making some behind-the-scenes moves that could affect. It's almost like an attitude, and I know you've had some feelings, some strong feelings about this. So Jessica Pacheco, who has been given credit or blame for being heavily involved in getting APS more involved in political spending, is now being bumped up to a vice president position, government affairs, this sort of thing. What does that say to you about what APS feels about regulation, or whether it feels like the company, the utility, is making at least a shift in perception?
Well, they're not. Maybe this is like the absolute wrong direction for them to go in, and shows that they haven't learned a darn thing about the public's perception of them, which is that they're really, frankly, one of the worst utilities in America right now, and they're toxic. But I will tell you this. I think context here is important. This move came in reaction to the fact that it was revealed that two people died as a result of APS's shutoff policy, which is that they were shutting off 1 out of 10 of their customers in the middle of the summertime, and two people died as a result. And I can tell you, as a former regulator, it is outrageous. It's extremely unusual. And if I were the commission, I would have hauled the CEO down immediately, and there would have been consequences for this. At APS, the consequence that resulted was that they fired, it looks like they fired their VP for communications, which is strange to me. The person who should have received consequences, speaking as a mom now, like when your kid receives consequences, but it's much more important, was the CEO, Don Brandt, was responsible for basically two people dying as a result of the policies of his company. That APS killed two people, basically. And, you know, I know that's stark, but it is true. What did they do? They fired their VP of communications, and they elevated a person who was responsible for basically being in charge of the political spending of this company, the lobbying of this company, at a time when the company's actions and all of that made the environment down at the Corporation Commission nearly toxic. So the fact that they elevated this individual is outrageous. It's unacceptable. I understand people don't know who she is, but at the end of the day, the person who should have been held to account and still should be is Donald Brandt, the CEO. I mean, let me give you, can I just...
By the Corporation Commission.
By the commission, exactly. And frankly, by his board, by the board of Pinnacle West. The vice president for operations of APS admitted to a reporter that the executives of this company were not aware that two people had died. They were not aware that their shutoff policies resulted in two people dying. It's outrageous. How could that be?
Well, and of course, we're not sure about SRP, because SRP is not... regulated by the commission. I mean, those are pretty strong words. Barrett, did you have anything on this?
Well, yeah. And first, several things. Number one, I mean, there are four people in this room. I think you have four listeners who probably know who or what a Jessica Pacheco is. She has taken on an expanded role. I don't see how a guy in his late 50s, maybe even early 60s, I'm not exactly sure how old he was, is retiring. Certainly, they put out a glowing release. It doesn't sound like firing to me. It doesn't sound like they are just trying to blame this person who's head of their communications outfit.
Well, then
department.
they're not holding anybody accountable, true.
But I don't see him as being fired in the least. I see him as retiring after 30 years in the business. It's a long time after 30 years in this business. I hope I, God willing, get to retire.
Do you think that the company is, then it's acceptable for them to hold no one accountable for what happened? For two people dying as a result of what they did?
APS has a pretty robust program to help people.
No, they don't.
Yes,
absolutely.
Listen,
they
do. But they have
3 seconds,
guys. And now,
I think they should have.
I think they should have some better communication to stop this in the future, and hopefully they have implemented that. And I know the commission now has implemented a policy, you know, no shutoffs during the summertime. Yeah. So, hopefully that will. But I think it was just, you know, they have a robust program. And, you know, this is an Arizona problem. Obviously, we live in the desert. This is an Arizona problem with all utilities. And we need to work with all utilities to stop this.
Barrett Morrison of Morrison Media, Chris Mays, former Corporation Commission Chair. Guys, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
This is the show on KJZZ 91.5 with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Still to come this hour, we'll hear more about how Arizona was connected to the Apollo 11 mission, and stay tuned to 10 for the takeaway.
The Arizona Corporation Commission has approved a new capital improvement plan for Johnson Utilities. That's the troubled water and wastewater utility that serves parts of Pinal County. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins normally works in our East Valley Bureau, but he's here now to speak with us about this latest development. Good morning, Jimmy.
Good morning, Mark.
So remind us exactly what's going on with this company and how it's impacting their customers.
Johnson is currently run by EPCOR. The Corporation Commission made them the interim manager in August of 2018 after customers were complaining of all kinds of things, but mainly it's just repeatedly low water pressure and then several large sewage overflows, so just repeated problems. So EPCOR has been reviewing Johnson's infrastructure, and in order to repair the system, to bring it to what the Corporation Commission staff called safe and adequate service, they've come up with, Mark, a plan.
Which the commission approved yesterday, right?
That's right, yes, at an open meeting and hearing of the Corporation Commission.
So what are they proposing? What is the scale? Is this like a small scale thing? Is more like a total gut job here?
Yeah, this is big. I'd say more like an overhaul. They're proposing 70 projects at a total cost of almost $130 million. The proposed projects include the expansion of 2 treatment facilities, the construction of a new wastewater treatment plant. It's things like replacing pumps, replacing lines, having the ability to treat more water, and having more flexibility when wells go down.
So, Jimmy, does Johnson have a say in any of this? I mean, their business is being held in sort of this custodial type process here.
That's right. It is. And an attorney for Johnson Utilities is always at the moderations and meetings and hearings. And one of the main objections they have to this plan is they're kind of saying, you're spending all this money building new facilities. What if, when the company hopefully does return to us, we then raise our rates to pay for it? You say we've overbuilt and we can't raise our rates, and then we're left holding the bag. So, but the commissioners didn't really seem concerned about that. In fact, one said something like, are you kidding me? You know, you're worried about having too much water. Your customers can barely get water as it is, unfortunately.
Wow. So, Jimmy, what's the timeline for this newly approved plan?
With the commissioner's vote yesterday, EPCOR can immediately begin work, and they said they would do so. Johnson Utilities now has 30 days to come up with a plan to pay for the improvements. Corporation Commission staff told me that short-term rate hikes for customers were unlikely, but EPCOR confirmed at this meeting yesterday that Johnson does not currently have enough money in its coffers to pay for it.
All right, certainly have to keep our eyes on this one. That's KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins. Jimmy, thank you.
My pleasure, Mark. Thank you.
The U.S. Supreme Court will decide the fate of about 25,000 Arizona DACA recipients in the upcoming court session this fall. President Obama created the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program via executive order in 2012. Since then, DACA recipients, or DREAMers as they've been called, have lived as quasi-citizens, having legal status but not the full rights granted to legal residents. The latest obstacle came last month when the Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, ruled that DREAMers are not eligible for FHA home loans. Dulce Matus is the co-founder of the Arizona Dream Act Coalition and is with me. Dulce, let's begin with a question about this move by HUD. What are the specifics and how could that affect DREAMers?
For the past year since DACA was announced, HUD, which is the Federal Housing Administration, it was very ambiguous as far as if they were going to be insuring loans given to DACA recipients. So it was the investors discretion to give these loans. And that's why it created a lot of confusion between DACA recipients, whether if they could be homeowners or not. We have been able to help a lot of DACA recipients to get loans, FHA loans, which main purpose is to make housing more accessible. Because if you have a lower credit or if you have some medical collections, we can work around that. Just recently, Ben Carson, the head of HUD, came out with a statement saying that FHA loans were no longer available for DACA recipients. It is very discouraging for a lot of people because it creates more confusion. Even though the DACA recipients are still eligible for conventional loans, I've been receiving a lot of calls and people asking me, can I be a homeowner or not? I think everybody deserves the right to have access to home ownership if they do what you're asked, if you build credit, if you have the down payment. And it's a merit-based achievement that every family should have. And I don't see why this administration will deny access to housing to DACA recipients.
When you hear people on opposite sides of the political aisle, pretty distinct on a lot of issues, even President Trump, even he has said at times at least that he supports DACA students, DACA recipients. So does it stun you that this is still, at least as far as it relates to those involved in DACA, that this is still going on, that there isn't anything solved, at least for that group of people?
I think having the DREAM Act pass is long overdue. When I started my work with passing legislation back in 2009, I thought it was a no-brainer. And I set a goal, well, this is only going to take a year. We're going to pass the DREAM Act in 2010. I mean, it's 2019 and it hasn't happened. I think that in some ways you get used to it, that politicians are more concerned about staying in power or getting in power than making a better Arizona or making a better country. And I think it goes back to us. And one thing that it was very important for me to become a citizen and participate in the elections is because I want my voice to be heard. And sometimes when something is taken away from you for such a long time, you don't take it for granted. So I want to challenge all the listeners out there that get discouraged because of the rhetoric on politics is that we have to hold those politicians accountable and participate. We can no longer stay on the sidelines, and we have to let our opinions be known. And if a politician is not doing what they're supposed to do, like passing the DREAM Act, then we say, you know what? You can't stay in power. We're going to vote you out. And I think that's the challenge that I have for everyone. I don't think that this is a Democrat or Republican issue. This is an American issue. This is to make Arizona better and to make our nation great. And we're a nation of immigrants. And we just need to educate ourselves and just listen to what's going on out there. Don't believe me. Do your own research and you'll be able to figure out because it's really easy.
The U.S. Supreme Court is going to take up DACA coming up in their next term, so in the fall. That can lead to a lot of anticipation as well. Is there going to be a good outcome, bad outcome, depending on where a person is situated? How much has that fact of the Supreme Court taking up the case, how has that affected your thoughts on it? How has it affected folks who come to you and wonder, what's next for me?
We always knew that DACA it is not robust enough. And the reason that we have DACA as an executive order is because Congress has failed to pass legislation. We have a gridlock Congress that doesn't do anything. So I think this is a challenge for us as constituents to go back and demand the DREAM Act to pass, because then the Supreme Court decision wouldn't matter as much. There's other avenues to get this solved. And because politicians choose not to get it solved, we can't stop right there. Every progress of change positive change that I've seen with the community, it doesn't come from a politician. So I wouldn't put my hopes and dreams on elected officials. I would put my hopes and dreams and ordinary people who are day-to-day fighting to make sure that we have good legislation for DACA recipients and dreamers.
All right. Dulcie Matus, good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
Yesterday, we reported on Flagstaff's pivotal role in preparing astronauts to travel to the moon. Today, we head south to explore how maps by institutions in Tucson and across Arizona revolutionized our understanding of their lunar destinations. From KJZZ's Arizona Science Desk, Nicholas Gerbis reports.
So here you're starting to see interesting features on the Terminator. You see these wrinkle ridges that were from lava flows that were in Maria.
Steve Larson of the University of Arizona's Lunar and Planetary Laboratory, or LPL, guides me through a photographic lunar atlas he worked on as a U of A undergraduate. His finger traces the dark basaltic plains to a very special spot.
You see not just craters, but domes and these wrinkled ridges. And this is where Apollo 11 landed.
July 1969, 50. We came in peace for all mankind.
To a motorist, a map is a fallback for when Google fails. But in ages of exploration, maps can change history.
Kuiper had gotten funding from NASA to build a 61-inch telescope up on Mount Lemmon for the express purpose of doing photography.
Gerard Kuiper is best known as the namesake of Pluto's neighborhood of icy remnants. But in the late 1950s, he was a strong proponent of lunar observation. LPL director Tim Swindle explains.
The best available maps in the late 1950s were hand-drawn, and the names of the features weren't even agreed on.
Ground-based telescopes allowed Kuiper's team to take photos at low sun angles, when lunar terrain stood out in stark relief. But he struggled to garner wider interest, until...
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
The organization started in fall of 1960. It was this niche project. And then in the spring of 1961, going to the moon became a national priority, so having a map was an obvious thing to do.
In 1961, years before he and Donald R. Davis proposed the dominant theory of how the moon formed, Bill Hartman was a graduate student working on Kuiper's rectified lunar atlas. That atlas involved projecting lunar photos onto a half globe about a yard wide.
And my job was to then work with an old-fashioned 4x5-inch film camera and walk around to the side of the globe and photograph formations on the moon from overhead.
That angle simulated what lunar astronauts would see. It also led Hartman to an insight about lunar geology.
I was walking around to the side, and lo and behold, what I could see was a series of multiple rings of mountains that were clearly part of a big, kind of a bullseye-shaped structure.
That pattern, which Hartman compares to the rings and radial fractures made by a bullet-piercing glass, piqued the interest of geologists. Soon they began to find them in most of the moon's large circular basins.
The mappers of the moon up in Flagstaff, the geologic mappers, immediately recognized, hey, yes, this is a structural geology pattern on the moon.
That led Hartman to what Swindle considers one of the most important insights in lunar history.
Oh, that's probably what a lot of these things on the near side looked like before other things wiped out bits and pieces of these rings of mountains around these hundreds of miles wide craters.
The Tucson team was not the sole moon mapping group. As Lowell Observatory historian Kevin Schindler explained, Lowell had a program from 1961 to 69, and the Air Force had its Aeronautical Chart and Information Center.
They essentially rented telescopes at Lowell, and then scientists worked with airbrush artists to create detailed maps of the moon.
Beyond Flagstaff training and Tucson mapping, Arizona supported mission control during the Apollo flights, and Arizona State University's Carlton Moore and others analyzed lunar samples. It was an exciting time, but it was just the beginning.
The people today are no less clever, and lunar science is by no means over. There's great stuff coming up in the next 50 years. Just don't know what it is.
Today, ASU and U of A are studying the moon via the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and lunar research continues in northern Arizona as well. So whatever those five decades hold, it's a good bet Arizona will be part of that, too. Nicholas Gerbis, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Farewell is a film about grief, family, and cultural divides. Rapper and actress Awkwafina plays Billy, a Chinese-American who returns to China to visit her terminally ill grandmother. The catch, however, is that Nai Nai doesn't know she's sick.
What's wrong, Dad? Please tell me.
My nan is dying.
She doesn't know, so you can't say anything. The family thinks it's better not to tell her.
Why is that better?
Chinese people have a saying. When people get cancer, they die.
We have to go to China.
Wedding is an excuse so everyone can see her.
He's my only cousin. Do you think I should be there?
You can't hide your emotions. If you go, Nana will find out right away.
The film premiered at Sundance earlier this year to much acclaim and has already exceeded box office expectations, despite having a limited release. The story rejects the stereotypes that have followed the Asian American community and is one of a handful of recent movies that tell compelling stories with a diverse cast. Doreen Kondo is a cultural anthropologist and professor at the University of Southern California. And Doreen, even though the film is centered on a Chinese American family, are their experiences something that all audiences can relate to?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, as you say, everyone has experienced some loss or will at some point. And, you know, many people have lost grandparents, parents. So I certainly myself found much to empathize with. And I've seen this film and, you know, people of all ethnicities and races seem to identify with that aspect. You know, I hear people, it's the bathroom conversations afterwards, right? So you hear people talking about, oh, you know, this person in their lives, you know, passed away or is sick and so on and so forth. So I think that it brings out those possibilities for empathy across the lines of cultural difference.
I read part of an interview with Randall Park who had talked about
having played
a doctor a bunch of times, and he said it wasn't terrible. It was okay. He wasn't playing, you know, someone who was a bad person, but it was just like, okay, this is sort of how audiences or filmmakers or television producers see us. As far as that goes, the expansion of Asian American representation as just where it blends almost the Asian American culture, but also we're just sort of the average person too. You don't have to look at us any differently. How important is that in terms of film, in terms of just seeing that process for people?
It's crucial. You know, I mean, the historical context of this, I mean, Randall Park has the experience of playing doctors. There's also a long history of, you know, evil agents in the opium den or drug lords on the run, that sort of thing. Or erasure. The Joy Luck Club was filmed in 1993. It's been a long, long time since we've seen, you know, an Asian American creative vision through the director starring Asian American actors. So, you know, it's high time for all different kinds of representation. So in Randall Park's case, that You'll Always Be My Maybe, it was kind of delightful to see an Asian American slacker character, frankly, in a rock band, you know. And similarly on television, Vincent Rodriguez III, who's the sort of was the object of desire, you know, in Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, as a kind of clueless jock, you know. So that was anti-stereotype as well.
When success like this happens, is it more successful for the director to go on to direct one of the big superhero movies, or is it for her to be able to keep her creative vision and do maybe a quote-unquote smaller film and continue that?
Ideally, I would like to see both.
Yes.
Both from this particular director and from, you know, all the other Asian American talent that's out there that's not getting, you know, distributed. But it would be great to see Asian American superheroes, you know, for example, Asian American women as superheroes. But it would also, who knows how many wonderful, nuanced, complicated stories there are out there. And that's what I also look forward to seeing. The director herself has said that, you know, called this kind of facetiously crazy middle class Asians. So we need more, you know, what about crazy working class Asians, you know, for example, or, you know, all kinds of stories that we can't even imagine. I could never have imagined this story. And it happened in quote unquote real life.
That is Doreen Kondo, a cultural anthropologist and professor at the University of Southern California. Thanks so much for the time today.
Thank you, Mr.
The Farewell is now playing exclusively at Harkins Camel View.
So, Steve, you know how during monsoon season all this stuff in your backyard kind of gets blown around, you have to go collect it every time?
Boy, Mark, it's so much fun. It's a real quintessential summer
activity. Yeah, you and I both love that. So what if you were at a school and after a storm, your whole playground was blown to the other side of the yard?
A metal playground. That would be something, yes.
Yes, so that's exactly what happened earlier this summer to a boys and girls club in eastern Arizona. The students in Eager came back to tell their director after an 80-mile-an-hour gust of wind that the playground was gone.
They come in after school and they go, Miss Manny, Miss Manny, the jungle gym is in the field.
That's Manny Bowler, director of the Boys and Girls Club of Round Valley, where the jungle gym took flight this year. She says the metal part of the playground was flipped upside down and flown about 20 feet away. The kids couldn't move that part, but they did work together to roll the plastic tower back into the building.
I kind of hope they didn't try to move that part. Yikes. Almost like fate, Manny was searching through old emails and found one from the design school at ASU asking if there was a project they could team up on.
So I jumped on that like nothing. I'm like, ooh, the design school wants to work with us. Hallelujah.
Boulder reached out to the design school, and the students got an opportunity to build themselves a new playground. Dakota Waters is a graduate student in industrial design at ASU who got to work on the project. He says the younger students and the older students actually wanted a lot of the same things: curved monkey bars, nets they could climb up into tall towers, and lots of slides. The ASU design students worked on building it, but Dakota says they couldn't do it all.
And one of them wanted, like, a whole golf course. And it was really fun to play around with them. One of them just asked, just bring Spider-Man out there, and it should be great.
Sadly, no Spider-Man, but the students of the Boys and Girls Club in Eager, Arizona, now have a brand new custom-built playground that hopefully won't get blown away in the next storm.
Mark, this should really be a rhetorical question because any place you live is automatically historic. But what do you think would actually take to make your house a historic site?
I think something historic and probably somebody actually who's known by anybody other than my family would have to live there.
Okay, well, I guess we could reserve it just for the already important people in Arizona like Justice Sandra Day O'Connor.
Yeah, she sounds like way more deserving than my house.
Good, because that's actually what happened. Her house has officially been added to the National Register of Historic Places.
Sounds pretty cool. So what exactly does that do for her?
Okay, so when places are added to the list, it's considered worthy of preservation and recognized nationally. Justice O'Connor's home of more than two decades is in Papago Park in Tempe today. That was after being moved from its original location in Paradise Valley about a decade ago.
That is a massive undertaking. Have you ever seen those houses on the freeway, like the on the backs of flatbed trucks? They are
oversized load. Is that
yeah,
what they
yes, says? I think that's what they're called. That is, I can't imagine actually just moving a house.
Yeah, I don't think we would be able to do that. We'd need some help.
I think I might have more luck moving that playground back. Yeah. From Eager than actually moving a house.
Do you think because of your presence in this studio, this will once be named at some point the historic Mark Brody studio?
I think there's more chance that it's the Steve Goldstein studio.
If the National Register of Historic Places is listening, that's what we need to go next.
Yeah, that's exactly what we need.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.